pleasure to call to order the very first meeting of the Energy Policy and Finance Committee. I should mention probably at the outset that one of the things that has been stressed in all of the new chair training to which I have been subjected is that it's a good idea to lay out some of the ground rules right away, and we will be publishing a set of rules and procedures probably for, in time for the next meeting. The only thing that I think I should point out today is that one of the things that I have observed over the years and resolved, if I ever had the opportunity to hold the gavel, I would do differently, is that I, first of all, intend to start these meetings on time. I intend to work very closely with our vice chair, Representative Rood, and we already have an understanding that if I'm not here on time, she's going to start the meeting, because we are going to start on time. We only have an hour and a half for these meetings, and we have a lot of very weighty subject matter to get through. And I think that we should do everything we can to utilize the time that we have. What we did today, just to make it more manageable for the staff, is to put out everyone's nameplate and folder, but what is my intention is that next week, if you don't like where you're sitting today, pick wherever you'd like to sit. This is not one of the options. And after that, we'll try to put out the folders where you prefer to be seated, and I think that'll help the pages get everything set up in a proper fashion. And the other thing that I want to mention today is that obviously we'll be hearing testimony from a lot of people, and there are a lot of opinions that abound about all of these issues that tend to produce little side conversations, and I think that if you find that you're engaging in one of those that's going to go to any length at all, I'd really appreciate it if you would just step out of the room or to the back of the room to do that, so that we can pay proper courtesy and attention to the people that are testifying. So what we would like to do today to begin with, and I should mention that some of the members are absent because there is a rules meeting that has been called for this time, and we have a number of members on this committee who are also members of the Rules Committee. Hopefully they'll be able to join us later. But we can't wait forever to do that, so I thought what we would do to begin with is just go around and do introductions if of the members and staff, and if you want to mention your experience or lack of it on this particular committee and your interest or lack of it in the committee, I suppose we'd be interested in hearing that as well. So I'll start with that, and then if we could go around with the members present, and then we'll introduce our staff, which I should say in advance, I think we're very lucky to have a really excellent staff component for this committee, as I'm sure you'll find out as we go along. So anyway, I'm Bill Hilty, starting my sixth term in the legislature and my fifth term on previously has been the Regulated Industries Committee. I was obliged in one session to miss being assigned to the committee, not by my choice, but because of an unmanageable scheduling conflict. It's one of the main interests that I've had in the legislature. In fact, issues having to deal with energy and regulated industries are one of the things that caused me to decide to run for the legislature in the first place. So I'm certainly happy to be here, and as I'm sure everyone in the room is aware, we're going to have a very full plate in this session. I don't mind saying that I think energy is the issue that we have to deal with in this session and in this decade. So with that, let's just do the introductions of those members that are present, and we'll give those that catch up with us later an opportunity at a later time. So let's start with our Vice Chair, Representative Rood.
Thank you. I'm Maria Rood. This is my second term, and I did serve on Regulated Industries last year, and still feel like I have a lot to learn, but happy to be here.
Representative Kate Knuth, and this is my first term and my first committee meeting. So I'm very excited to be here, and I think energy issues are, I agree with you, one of the biggest challenges we have in the coming years.
Representative Andy Welty, I represent portions of Olmsted and Wabasha counties, and I am interested in the subject area, and I was appointed to it. I feel that there's going to be quite a bit of overlap between the Agriculture Committee this year and the Energy Committee, because in the Agriculture Committee we are focusing some of our time and emphasis on renewable energy. And hopefully there will be an ethanol plant built within my district within the next year or two. There's an initiative underway. There are a number of ethanol plants close to my district, but I'd actually like to have one directly in my district soon. And besides that, I know that there are a lot of complex issues with regulation and power grid and everything else. So I'm really looking forward to learning about the issues, and I look forward to working with many of the people who are in the audience. I have to say, I think this is the committee where I see the most number of people in attendance watching what we do.
I'm sure that will continue to be the case.
I'm Representative David Bly from District 25B, representing Northfield and Belle Plaine, and I have had a long interest in energy and impact of energy on the environment. I also have interest in community energy development, and in my district there are two wind turbines that were put up by private colleges, and there is some talk about an ethanol plant with mixed feelings going into my district possibly.
Rita Saylor, District 2B up north, which is the western half of Hubbard County, almost all of Beltrami, almost all of Clearwater, and a little bit of Polk and Pennington. So I do have a large district. Energy is something that I've been involved with for a number of years professionally and then just personally interested in that. I think it is indeed probably one of the largest things, or if not the largest issue that we face as a state and nation. I look at energy as the fact that we need to have a well-developed patchwork of how we get our energy resources so that we're not reliant on just one or two sources. The more broad-based we are, the better it will be for our economy, our security, and the environment.
I'm Linda Slocum from District 63B, which is East Richfield, East and Central Bloomington. I'm interested in the subject of energy. I think it's cutting edge, and what she said makes sense to me.
Jean Wiginius, South Minneapolis, between Diamond Lake and Lake Nokomis. I am super glad to be on this committee and worried a lot about the global warming impact on Minnesota, and this is a good place to discuss what we can do about it.
Representative Jeremy Kalin from Chisago County, home of two state parks and the wonderful St. Croix River. And my professional training is in architecture and planning. I actually worked as a designer before coming here to the legislature, and so really passionate about energy issues and our infrastructure in general. I had some experience with the transmission system from the citizen activist perspective, and so really concerned about upgrading our transmission infrastructure quite a bit. And my passion for the subject for energy independence comes because I think it's the kind of win-win-win solution that national security, economic development, and the kind of community planning and community pride that we can really be a shining example for the nation.
Kathy Breinert, this is my first term. I represent the Mankato area, the city of Mankato, surrounding townships, and just a tiny sliver of North Mankato. And I've been empowered by my community to speak to this issue. We had a strategic planning process called Envision 2020 in our region, and issues of sustainability and renewable energy were very aggressively addressed, both from the environmental point of view and the economic development point of view, with not necessarily reconcilable views. So I'm looking forward to this. I have a lot to learn, and I feel like there's a lot of people on this committee I can look to for that expertise.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Paul Gardner from Shoreview in District 53A. About a year and a half ago, I helped set up a Sierra Communities group in Shoreview. And when I started campaigning, I got off that group. But since then, folks in Shoreview have actually gone door to door to sign up people for Xcel's WindSource program. I thought it was kind of hard door knocking for our office, but they really had an interesting experience. But they actually doubled the number of customers buying into WindSource by doing that, and I hope they'll come up and see how things work here.
I'm Representative Johnson, the only Johnson still serving in the legislature. And my interest is largely long-range planning for the state's energy needs, and interested in working on that.
My name is Dennis Osmond, Rosemount in Eastern Apple Valley, my legislative district. Served in the legislature for 22 years, and a dozen years ago I was the Republican lead on the Energy Committee, so I'm glad to be back.
I'm Joe Hoppe. I'm starting my third term from Chaska. I represent Chanhassen and Chaska. And Mr. Chair, is it okay to ask a question?
Absolutely.
I'm wondering if we're going to continue our bipartisan tradition of new members bringing treats.
We'll try to take that into consideration before we publish the rules next week.
As long as the senior members do some stuff.
I represent Tom Hackbarth. I represent Northern Anoka County and part of Sherburne County, the city of Elk River, and starting my sixth term.
I'm Representative Bob Gunther. I represent District 24A down in Fairmont, St. James, and Blue Earth.
I'm Mike Beard. I represent the cities of Shakopee and Prior Lake, which are known as District 35A. I'm beginning my third term, and was fortunate enough to serve on the Regulated Industries Committee for the first 4 years I was here, and I'm happy to be back for years 5 and 6.
I'm Bob Eliff from the House Research Department. This will be my fourth session staffing this committee, which means I've been around here long enough to offer that as a lack of experience rather than a surfeit of experience, because I'm fully aware of how much I still don't know.
I'm Andy Pomeroy, the committee administrator for the committee.
And I'm Rebecca Smith, the committee legislative assistant.
I'm Ron Soderberg. I'm with House Fiscal, and look forward to working with everyone.
And we have two pages that have been assigned. If you, Andy, you want to?
Okay. I'm Andy Larson. I'm one of the pages.
I'm John Slade. I'm the other.
Ernest came in.
Where did he go?
There he is.
Oh, you're looking
at me? Yes. Representative Nernis, we had just concluded going around doing introductions and giving people an opportunity to
mention any background or interest I had in this committee if you choose to do so.
Okay,
so
sure.
I guess you're up.
Well, thank you. Sorry, it's a little late. I'm Representative Bud Nornes. Represent District 10A, which is Purvis Falls and the west half of Otter Tail County, west central Minnesota. I'm in my 11th year in the legislature. Purvis Falls is the home of Otter Tail Power Company, so that's one of my interests in the power industry, along with Great Plains Natural Gas Company and Lake Region Co-op Electric, which I'm a customer of. And so I'm looking forward to being on this committee and getting some work done.
Thank you. And we neglected in the introductions to identify the caucus research staff. We have with the DFL caucus research Eileen Shore and our constituent services, member Mary Sturm. And I don't know, does Minority have a researcher at this point? Thank you. I should mention also, I tried to get together with members of the committee one-on-one for at least a brief meeting before this meeting. We didn't accomplish that entirely, and I would like to manage to meet with everyone within the next few days if we can arrange that on our schedules. One of the things that I noted when I started doing that is that we have kind of a richness of former committee chairs in this committee. I think there are six altogether. So I'm thinking that being new myself to some of these procedures, if sticky questions arise and seven of us together can't get it figured out, we're really going to be in trouble. I'm certainly looking forward to working with everybody on the committee, and I want to underscore that I'm really open to advice and suggestions from every member, and certainly those amongst us that have had a lot of experience, not only on this committee, but also on chairing other committees, and I'm sure you'll be happy to tell me ways in which the conduct of this one might be improved. What I wanted to do today is, particularly for the new members on the committee, and from last year to this, at least, I think we have nine members who were not on this committee last year, six of whom were not in the legislature last year. So I thought it would be appropriate to have House Research, Mr. Eloff, give us just kind of an overview of where we've been in the past few years. We've passed major pieces of legislation relevant to this committee, and we have a number of things coming up that we will obviously be dealing with. One of the major ones, of course, is that we will be dealing with proposals that the governor has brought forward that I think are very encouraging and quite comprehensive, and we'll be hearing from the Department of Commerce a little bit later and giving us an overview of the governor's proposal, but we'll start with a little bit of history for Mr. Eloff, if you would care to proceed with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope in my remarks today to achieve three objectives. The first is to summarize some of the major energy legislation that was enacted since 2001 by the legislature. Also, to give new members an idea of the variety of energy issues that come before this committee. And third, and I think most importantly, as the Chair just mentioned, to provide some historical background, not only because it gives us a clearer view of where we've come from and why, but also because it's going to be important for issues that are likely to come up this session, two specifically, the promotion of renewable energy issues or energy sources in Minnesota, and also the expansion of nuclear storage capacity in the state. And that's why I'd like to start not in 2001, but actually back in 1994 with what's come to be known as the Prairie Island legislation, which created a framework for dealing with nuclear waste storage, and also from which many of the state's renewable energy programs has sprouted. The story actually begins back in 1989 when Xcel Energy, then known as Northern State Power Company, applied to the Public Utilities Commission for a certificate of need to construct a spent nuclear fuel storage facility at its Prairie Island nuclear facility. As the certificate of need process went its way, the administrative law judge examined all the testimony that was offered and had to decide one very important factor on whether that facility would be permanent or temporary. The reason that's important is because the 1977 law indicated that if indeed it was permanent, then the legislature had to approve the facility. The administrative law judge decided that the facility was permanent and required legislative approval under that 1977 law. That recommendation then went to the Public Utilities Commission, which has the authority to either accept it or reject it or modify it. And the PUC disagreed with the administrative law judge regarding permanence, deciding that the storage was indeed temporary. It granted the certificate of need, and it authorized the construction of 17 tasks for storing nuclear waste material. That decision by the PUC was taken to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, which found that the evidence supported the commission's approval of the certificate of need, but also said that the storage is, in its words, more likely than not permanent and required legislative approval, which created quite a controversial session, I'm told, not having been around here. What emerged from that controversy was an act which did accomplish four major goals. One, it gave approval or authorization for 17 dry casks to be constructed at Prairie Island. Based on the company incorporating specified amounts of wind and biomass energy into its mix, and also investigating at that time an alternative site for storage. Second, it established a renewable development account to which Xcel was to contribute $500,000 per year for each of the 17 casks, and that revenue was to be used for renewable energy programs. The legislation also established a renewable energy mandate for Xcel. It had to incorporate 825 megawatts of wind power and 125 megawatts of biomass into its system by specified times. And finally, that legislation created the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force, which is a body made up of equal numbers of House and Senate members that studies electricity issues and nuclear management issues and makes recommendations to the legislature. That was 1994. If we can fast forward to 2001, that was the year the legislature established the renewable energy objectives, which requires utilities beginning in 2005 to generate or purchase 1% of their total retail electricity sales from a list of eligible renewable energy technologies, and that percentage is to increase until in 2015, 10% of each utility's and of the state's retail electricity sales are generated from renewable fuels. Xcel is the only company that was mandated with achieving that goal. The other utilities that are subject to that law are to put forth a good faith effort to achieve that goal, and the PUC has since put forth some determinations of what a good faith effort really is. The renewable energy objectives applies to investor-operated utilities, to municipal power agencies, and also to generation and transmission cooperatives, but not to municipal munis or co-ops that are just distribution munis or co-ops. Another significant piece of legislation that resulted in 2001 was a streamlining of the certificate of need process itself. With energy demand increasing, it's felt that one of the potential roadblocks to meeting that demand are state regulatory processes themselves. So several things were done to streamline the certificate of need process. First, the commission, Public Utilities Commission, which issues certificate of need, is allowed to use a single proceeding for that for both the generation and associated transmission lines, putting that into one decision essentially rather than two separate ones. Also, the PUC was allowed to certify certain transmission projects as part of a state transmission plan, which was a new idea, looking at reliability, using the same need criteria as they would in a certificate of need hearing, and also determining whether that transmission was in the public interest. The thought behind that was that if these projects would be certified in the state transmission plan in advance of when they would be needed, that would save time when indeed they were needed. And finally, the legislation exempted certain projects from the certificate of need process altogether, such as modifying existing facilities to increase efficiencies, again, to streamline the process. At that time, Minnesota also, in addition to the certificate of need process, once that was completed, projects went then through the siting process. Where would they be placed in the state? And that process was also streamlined. At that time, it was the Environmental Quality Board that made that decision on siting and routing of transmission lines. And it was determined that the EQB must make that decision within a 15-month time period, and an expedited process for smaller facilities of 9 months was also passed by the legislature. Certain small projects were also allowed to be sited and routed by local governments rather than the state. Changes were also made in 2001 with respect to conservation. Energy guidelines were established for new and existing public buildings, and modifications were also made to the state's conservation improvement program, which requires utilities to make certain amounts of expenditures on conservation for residential, commercial, and industrial customers. The municipal utilities have been required to spend 1% of the gross operating revenues on these programs. That was increased to 1.5%. And cooperatives, the amount they spent on these programs was also increased by requiring them to take a percentage off of retail revenues rather than wholesale gross revenues. The Department of Commerce, which administers the Conservation Improvement Program, also developed a list of specific conservation programs that utilities can offer under what's known as the CIP program. And lastly, I wanted to mention another piece of legislation that was passed in 2001. The Public Utilities Commission was given the authority to order utilities to make infrastructure investments and to undertake sufficient preventive maintenance expenditures regarding generation, transmission, and distribution facilities. When I was preparing this, for some reason, it seemed that most of the legislation happened in odd-numbered years, which I think may augur well for this committee, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to skip to 2003 next. One of the major issues that the legislature dealt with was authorizing, this is now 9 years after Prairie Island, the legislature authorized additional nuclear waste storage at Prairie Island, 12 more casks, which was deemed to be sufficient until the licenses of the two units there expired in 2012 and 2014, respectively. The legislature also specified that storage was temporary and required that it be managed to facilitate out-of-state shipment as soon as feasible, and also set up some rules for future storage, which is going to be important to this legislature and this committee. First, it said future storage needs a certificate of need from the Public Utilities Commission. An EIS is required for any expansion of existing storage or new storage construction. And finally, it said that the decision coming out of the Public Utilities Commission on nuclear storage, it gave the legislature the opportunity to review that decision. And as you may know, at the end of December, the Public Utilities Commission made a decision regarding nuclear storage at Monticello that under this law will now be delayed until June 1st, giving this legislature the opportunity to review that decision if it would like to do so. Another important measure that was passed in 2003 increased Xcel's contribution to that renewable development account. It went from $500,000 per cask to a total of $16 million annually. Now, $6 million of that each year, is, at least through 2018, is allocated to the renewable energy production incentives. These are payments that are made to producers of renewable energies per kilowatt hour that they produce. It began with hydropower was the first technology to be awarded the REPI, what we call it. And in 1995, wind became eligible to receive these payments as well. 1.5 cents a kilowatt hour produced for a period of 10 years, and up to 100 megawatts of wind capacity statewide was authorized to do that in 95, and that's since been doubled, so we now have 200 megawatts of wind capacity that receive these payments. Of that $6 million, $4.5 million is to go to small wind producers. $1.5 million is for on-farm biogas production. That leaves $10 million, which is annually, which is used to fund renewable energy projects. In 2003, when this legislation was passed, it was directed that $10 million go to the University of Minnesota's initiative on renewable energy and environment, and that program continues to get 5% of that $10 million until 2008. There's a board called the Renewable Development Fund Board that is made up of a wide array of stakeholders that reviews projects. Essentially, they're operating as they review projects that come in and decide which one should be funded. They actually make those recommendations to the Public Utilities Commission, which makes the final decision. One more piece of legislation in 2003 was passed, provided regulatory incentives for an innovative coal project on the Iron Range, among which were exempting them from certificate of need requirement, awarding them power of eminent domain, and entitling them to contract with Xcel for 450 megawatts of baseload capacity. 2005. Again, we had a number of provisions designed to promote the construction of electric transmission lines. And maybe a little background here is necessary. This is really a problem that I think is being faced nationwide, not only in Minnesota. It basically reflects the fact that since the 1970s, new transmission lines have grown at about half the rate of electricity demand. And I think the way we were all able to survive with that for a period of 30 years was a combination of conservation, construction of a lot of gas peaking plants, and purchases from the grid. But the numbers are indicating that that way of surviving is not likely to be around much any longer. It turns out that it's much harder to build transmission lines than it used to be because of a whole host of changes that have been made in electricity markets that largely go under the notion of restructuring those markets to make them more market-based. The point being that we've been looking for ways to make that construction of electric transmission lines easier. And in 2005, we passed a number of provisions to that effect. One was with respect to cost recovery. Legislature allowed that after the PUC reviewed a transmission line project outside of a rate case, which is a procedure that utilities go through these days, I guess, about once every 10 years if they can avoid it. This is a very detailed look at all the utilities' costs and expenditures by the Public Utilities Commission and resulting in usually an increase in rates for a specified amount of time. What this legislation did was allow cost recovery of transmission line costs to be done outside of that rate case on a more automatic basis, although the PUC continues to review them. Another piece of legislation allowed the utility, again after review and approval by the PUC, to transfer operational control of their transmission assets to a transmission company that's under jurisdiction of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Transmission companies are companies that do only transmission, and they've been, in essence, popping up over the last few years as a way of getting more transmission. This allows Minnesota utilities to transfer their assets to those companies, and also provided for those companies to be treated as utilities with respect to being assessed for regulatory procedures in Minnesota. They can also be ordered to make infrastructure or preventive maintenance expenditures and must submit final reports to the PUC. Another change that was made to make transmission line building easier was with respect to the certificate of need process, whereas in the past, the process looked only to the interests of state ratepayers or state citizens in terms of whether these facilities were needed.
The change now requires the PUC to evaluate the relationship of any individual project to regional needs, to take into account the benefits of enhanced regional accessibility or reliability or regional access or regional deliverability. That's a big change. The PUC also was given authority to approve expenditures made for studies to identify new transmission facilities that will serve the REO of particular utilities, again, making it easier for people to plan those kinds of projects. The routing and siting authority I spoke of earlier, which was housed in the Environmental Quality Board, was transferred to the Public Utilities Commission in 2005. Again, putting both parts of the decision-making process, both for need and routing and siting, in the same body, and it was expected that joint hearings could be done, which would save time during the process. Another important piece of legislation passed in 2005 was promoting community-based ownership of wind facilities in Minnesota. It required the Utilities Commission to develop and each utility to offer what's called a seabed tariff, another terrible acronym we have, which stands for community-based energy development. That tariff can be up to 2.7 cents per kilowatt hour on a net present value basis over the 20-year life of the purchase power agreement for the wind facility. The important point about it is that that rate is higher in the first 10 years to recover the capital costs than it is in the last 10 years. And the legislature set up certain criteria for projects becoming seabed criteria, one of which is that the projects are 2 megawatts or less, but also regarding the ownership of those projects. A seabed project must be owned by what's called a qualifying owner for a period of 20 years. Qualified owner is a Minnesota resident, a limited liability corporation made up of Minnesota residents, a Minnesota nonprofit, a Minnesota co-op, except for rural electric co-ops or generation transmission co-ops, a Minnesota political subdivision, not including a municipal power authority, or a tribal council. Other ownership criteria include a project that consists of more than 2 turbines. No single qualified owner can own more than 15% of that project. If the project is only 1 or 2 turbines in size, a qualified owner must receive at least 51% of the total financial benefits over the life of the project. These projects also need the resolution of support from a county board or a tribal council. They're not eligible for that production incentive I mentioned before. And again, the Public Utilities Commission has to approve the power purchase agreement and also give ratepayers an opportunity to address the reasonableness of the rate that's set. Another important piece of legislation required the state to conduct what's called a wind integration study, essentially to study the impacts on both costs and grid reliability of expanding wind in Minnesota to become 15 or 20 or 25% of retail electric sales. That study was completed in December, and I believe the results will probably be presented to this committee in a few weeks. Another change that was made in 2005 was that all the funding for the renewable energy production incentives now comes from the renewable development account. Previously, half of it had come from the renewable development account, half of it from the general fund. Now it's all coming from the renewable development account. 2005 also saw some initiatives with respect to the development of hydrogen in the state. The Department of Administration is required to report to the legislature with a list of proposed pilot projects to increase Minnesota's use of hydrogen. And also, utilities are assessed $300,000 in fiscal year 2006 and 2007 to match some federal and private investment funds in multi-fuel hydrogen fueling facilities stations in the Twin Cities and Moorhead and Alexandria. There are a few other pieces of legislation passed in 2005. The legislature appropriated $25,000 for a study of the benefits of using biodiesel for a home heating fuel, and that report will be due on March the 15th. And finally, we also did some made allowance for expedited cost recovery for natural gas infrastructure that is relocated and replaced as a result of public construction projects. And again, the PUC can review those projects outside of a general rate case. That's kind of a greatest hits list of the last 5 years, Mr. Chairman. I've missed a lot, but I think you get the flavor of what we've been doing here.
It was an awesome undertaking. I really appreciate the detail that you gave us, Pastrilov. And I hope that members that are still awake did find that helpful. No disrespect, but these are very difficult issues to get your head around, and I think that probably what it does for many of us is just to suggest the complexity of these issues. And we'll be hearing more about all of these in the near future. What we wanted to do with the rest of the time today is to hear from the Department of Commerce, from Deputy Commissioner Ed Garvey and Assistant Commissioner Mike Bull, who have been working on the draft of the Governor's Energy Initiative bill. And we asked them to come and give us a little overview. I'm sure that many members, if not all of the members of this committee, have encountered people who have had questions about what those proposals entail and what we should anticipate. And so we wanted to get it straight from the horse's mouth, as it were.
All right.
We do have the end straight here.
Should there be one end of the horse? I get to choose which end. You're the deputy. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner for Energy and Telecommunications at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Thank you very, very much for this honor to be here. It's good to have you back. I look forward to working with you through the next several months on issues of great common interest to achieve the public's good. I'm here on behalf of Commissioner Glenn Wilson and Governor Tim Pawlenty. I'll give the brief overview of the Department of Commerce, my division. I'll talk briefly about a couple parts of the Governor's three-part Next Generation Energy Initiative package. Those two parts are going to be specifically on the less carbon and more efficiency part. And then Assistant Commissioner for Renewable Energy and Advanced Technologies, Mike Bull, will back clean up and talk specifically about the Governor's renewable energy initiative components of that Next Generation Energy Initiative. Very briefly, the Energy and Telecom Division of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm the deputy of that. I oversee that on behalf of Commissioner Glenn Wilson. There are about 75 staff people of that division. About 10 of them work on telecommunications. The remainder work on energy. The energy portions of that division have three parts mainly. One is low-income energy assistance. The LAHEAP program flows through my division. We give out roughly $80 million in financial assistance to those in financial need for the home heating seasons. Another part of my division is the State Energy and Information Office. This is where citizens across the state contact and get information on energy conservation, how to weatherize their home, how to improve their efficiencies of their appliances. It also provides a look at advanced technologies such as wind and solar and those kind of things, but those more come under the purview of Mike's section. The remainder of the staff is what I would characterize as utility regulation and oversight. These provide public policy and advocacy and analysis of the filings of our utilities for the benefit of the Public Utilities Commission. There are about 45 members of that unit. They're overseen by, managing by Mariah White. It has, it oversees the electric utilities, the natural gas, and the routing and siting staff. Most of their work product goes through me, through Mariah, to the Public Utilities Commission in their decision-making process.
So we serve as not only a public policy advisor to you and the governor, but also staff and analysts of utility dockets for the Public Utilities Commission, who ultimately makes most of the decisions on those matters. Having given you a quick overview of my division, I now want to turn to the governor's energy agenda. On December 12th of 2006, Governor Plante announced the Next Generation Energy Initiative. It had three parts: more renewables, more efficiency, less carbon. As I mentioned, Mike will talk about the renewables portion of that. I'll talk about the efficiency and carbon. I'll start with efficiency. Energy efficiency is a very, very important part of any energy system. Using less energy is always better than using more. It saves money, it prevents new infrastructure from needing to be built, and it saves the environment. We do a lot. We have one of the best energy efficiency programs in the country in this state. We can do more. We should do more. We should do more for several reasons. First, we are in a period of infrastructure growth. We need more transmission lines. We need more generation facilities. We're driving more. So we're using more energy at a time when we want to reduce, so we can do more. The governor has concluded that the way to do more is to set up a goal for the state to reduce our energy use, particularly from fossil fuel sources. The goal that he has set was that we reduce our fossil fuel energy use by 15% by 2015. It is an overarching goal. It is a statewide goal. It says reduce our fossil fuel use. The primary tool for doing that will be energy efficiency and conservation. We also believe that the growth of renewables is also a very, very positive part and can be and should be used as part of our tools to reduce our fossil fuel reliance. But the primary tool will be energy efficiency and conservation for achieving that goal. He's identified a couple specific proposals for how to do that. One is to change the state's energy conservation program, commonly referred to as CIP, or CIP for the Conservation Improvement Program, which is a spending requirement on our utilities. The current law requires each of our utilities to spend a specific amount of their gross operating revenues on energy efficiency and conservation. XL Energy has to spend 2%. The other electrics, 1.5%. The gas, 0.05, or half a percent. In sum, our utilities will be spending roughly $100 million on energy efficiency and conservation, a significant amount of money. They spend it. They develop the programs on how to do that. They file plans with my department on how to spend that money. My analysts look at it and make sure that they spend it wisely, that they get more money, more savings, more economic value than a dollar that's spent. And we do. The Legislative Auditor's Office reviewed this program several years ago and concluded that the review was doing well, and that they were doing well, and they were actually making money, $3 to $4 for every dollar that was spent. So that program is a very, very good program. The governor has concluded that we can improve on that program, though. Because that program is designed as a spending goal. It's designed to say, let's make them spend the money and follow the money and make sure that they spend that money well. Not a bad way of doing things. But it's not necessarily the best way of doing things. Because at the end of the day, it's not about the money that is being spent. It's about the energy that's being saved. And so the governor has concluded and recommends and is urging that we transition that program from a spending program to an energy savings program with a goal. The question then becomes is, what is that goal? What do we replace the expenditure requirement with? The savings goal. The governor has recommended that we expect each of our utilities to try to reduce the growth, their annual growth of energy by 1.5% each year. For example, if you're growing at 3% each year, we want you to try to reduce that load growth by 1.5%. It's an aggressive goal, but it's an achievable goal. It's more than they're achieving now, even under the current SIP program. But we think that when you're in a growth mode, and energy efficiency is so important for all the reasons I've already listed, we think that they can do more. So we think that that is one of the programs that we strongly urge people to consider. And we'll be introducing legislation as part of a package to implement that. The other part of the governor's energy savings initiative is to increase the number of buildings that get the ENERGY STAR rating. Many of our office buildings use a lot of energy in their lighting, in their heating, their cooling, their ventilation. The ENERGY STAR program comes in and basically works with the building managers and dramatically improves the overall energy use and conservation and efficiency of the building, saving everyone a lot of money and effort and time. In many respects, improves the comfort and livability and workability of those offices. So we had set out a goal to increase the number of ENERGY STAR buildings in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, that is the energy efficiency part of the Governor's Next Generation Initiative. It has three parts. The savings, the overall state energy savings goal of 15% by 2015, transitioning from a spending to a savings program for our SIP program, and more ENERGY STAR buildings. I'll now move to the governor's less carbon portion of his next generation energy initiative.
Mr. Garvey, before we do that, perhaps we should ask if members have questions on this portion of your testimony. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Garvey, just I'm new to this, so help me understand the governor's proposal. When you say reduce fossil fuel use by 2015 by 15%, is that all the fossil fuel used in Minnesota, or is that just the fossil fuel used in producing electricity?
Mr. Garvey.
Chairman, Representative Reed, it would be all fossil fuels used in the state of Minnesota.
And it
transportation fuels, heating fuels, okay. Electrical generation fuels.
Okay,
Representative Wilkins.
Thank you. If I could follow up. Well, that's better than I thought.
Good.
Is it the energy produced here, consumed here? Is the energy used, like if we have a big stone and that comes online, is that counted in the mix or not?
Commissioner Garvey.
If we use it here.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Virginius, a better example would be we produce no oil or petroleum in the state of Minnesota, but we use a lot of it. We believe that through growth of renewable fuels such as ethanol and biofuels, you can reduce your reliance on that fuel. So it is the use of the fuel in the state of Minnesota, not the amount produced.
Oh, thank you.
Further questions? And Commissioner, you want to get into the carbon question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the third prong of the governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative package is less carbon. Greenhouse gas emissions, global warming, climate change, etc., is an issue that deserves our attention. It's a problem that we didn't cause. We will not be able to solve as an individual state, yet we have a role and we contribute to it, and we have an obligation to address that contribution. We believe that the way to address that is through the use of our energy the choices on how we use energy, and that sort of thing. So we view that as an energy policy question. And working with the Pollution Control Agency and others, that we think that we can put together a way to address Minnesota's contribution. But the governor has asked that we address that by developing a climate action plan. It will be developed by an entity that's based out of Washington, D.C., the Washington, D.C. area, the Center for Climate Strategies, which has developed these plans for a number of states across the country, for example, New Mexico, Arizona, California, New York. We've asked them to come and talk to us about their process and how they did it, what were their outcomes, whether they could achieve the governor's desire of aggressively addressing our emissions in the state. We think that they can, and we will probably be asking them in the near future to come in and start a year-long stakeholder process to develop an action plan through 07 that will be ready for both administrative and legislative review next session. So we need to do this across the board. We need to look at all of our emissions. We need to identify them, identify how we can address them, and put in place methods for doing so. And that's what this plan will do. The other parts of the governor's less carbon approach is that the state of Minnesota, as an operating entity, has its own role in this. And he's asked us to work with the Department of Administration, the Pollution Control Agency, and all the other state agencies to figure out whether we can address and reduce the state of Minnesota's operating emissions by joining one of the national registries that do that. An example of one of those registries is the Chicago Climate Exchange. The University of Minnesota has already joined that exchange. We've had them into the state, as a matter of fact, this morning to tell us about their proposal and how that works. But we are looking at that, and we want to address Minnesota's, the state's, role in these emissions. We also think that we're not an island, that these emissions are done throughout the country and certainly throughout the world, and that by partnering, particularly with our neighboring states, we have a better chance of providing more economic, more wide-scale, and more efficient carbon emissions. And so the governor will be sending letters to his colleagues in the upper Midwest, asking them to work with him to develop a regional way to address carbon. The fourth component of the governor's less carbon approach is to acknowledge that when we are in a hole, you stop digging. And so what he has suggested is that any new fossil-fueled electrical generation facility that is going to serve Minnesota load offset its carbon emissions. Those are the four parts of the governor's less carbon portion of the Next Generation Energy Initiative. Asking for a comprehensive, inclusive stakeholder group to develop a climate change action plan by the end of this year. The state of Minnesota start looking at its own emissions and find ways to reduce them, and probably by joining a national registry. Asking our neighboring states to consider joining with us in a way to address regional emissions, and asking our utilities or any new facilities to offset their new emissions. So, Mr. Chairman, those are two components of a three-part package. None of these parts work well independently. They work very, very well together. More efficiency, less carbon complement each other. But without renewables, you're only one third of the way there. Renewables becomes the third leg of this very, very important stool that I think you all want to stand on. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Assistant Commissioner Bull to present the Governor's renewables portion of the Next Generation Energy Initiative.
Thank you, Commissioner Garvey. And before we go to Mr. Bull, are there questions for Commissioner Garvey? Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the issue of reducing fossil fuel. You're mentioning the potential for new facilities that might use fossil fuel. Made me consider the question of what measure we would use to in the 15% reduction. Are we talking about an absolute measure or a proportionate measure? Because if we're increasing generation, you know, how will we decide what's the standard going to be?
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brenner?
Yeah, hi.
This is one of those kind of very, very difficult kinds of questions to address. We need to address these issues. At the same time, we need to make sure that we don't injure ourselves or limit the state's economic vitality. That's why that 15% by 2015 is designed as a goal. It would take us back to 1990 level emissions. It's a 2% reduction of our growth. And so as we look at it, we want to sort of, and that's actually one of the kind of struggles, whether it is an absolute reduction or it's a growth level. So the way we've answered it is on a per capita basis. That allows for the growth, but it also addresses that growth level.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Galen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I have a two-part question, actually. And the first, is it fair to characterize the carbon offsets from new generation as carbon neutral?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Caitlin.
Welcome. Carbon neutral has taken on a term of art. At least to me it has. The offset systems, as we think about it, there are three ways to do offsets. There is capture and sequestration. There is the trading, and there is the terrestrial sequestration, which is buying or managing forestry lands, agricultural lands, wetlands, or absorption. So to basically make it truly absolutely neutral is one of the things that we're trying to sort of say, if ideally yes, but offset is what we're trying to do, to give ourselves some room, because you're not quite sure exactly how you can do it for each individual types of facility.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Galen.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the flexibility and the vision that the plan represents for the state. I'm wondering how far we might be able to extend that vision if there are other bulk or large-scale areas of carbon production in Minnesota that are on the table, that have been talked about and maybe looked at as not being yet feasible, or other areas. For example, we know that at some point I'll probably raise his work more openly in this committee with greater concentration, but architect Ed Mazzaria from the Southwest has realized that just by doubling our fuel efficiency, we remove 1.5% of all the carbon, or certainly all the energy use, and probably an equivalent amount of carbon there. Small scale on one level, but also large scale impact for for a moderate investment of technology and infrastructure. I'm just curious how far, or what's been looked at, if there's if the governor has an open mind and to looking at other areas as well, that we can make real progress in economic development here.
Senator Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Keeling. One of the critical components of the governor's idea to addressing carbon is to use a comprehensive stakeholder approach to aggressively address our emissions, to actually come up with ideas exactly like you like Representative Keeling just indicated, that you can improve building use through energy efficiency and their emissions, etc. And that's actually one of the very specific ideas that you want a set of folks to come in and sort of say, how do you do that? And that's what the stakeholder process with the experts from across the state would actually be working on and bring back to us and to you.
Thank you.
And Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rory, if I could follow up on Representative Barnard's question. When you answered that it would be per capita, and we're expecting a fairly substantial growth of people in Minnesota, then what does that translate to in terms of real reduction or absolute reduction? And if I had one follow-up.
Commissioner Garvey?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Virginius. It would take us back. I don't know the specific answer, and I can calculate that number. Actually, one of the smart people on my staff would be able to calculate that number relatively quickly. It might be the best to sort of stop there before I follow the governor's own advice and just not, you know, dig. But I think I can give you that number in a way that is done.
That would be helpful and to share it with us.
And Representative Virginia.
Thank you. And to follow up, I'm not quite understanding what the governor is proposing here. Is this a goal that we're going to just have voluntary compliance like we've had on some of the other things in the past, or are you going to be presenting strategies here that we're going to enact into law that will have some real teeth?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you're talking about the energy efficiency component, correct?
The fossil fuel, I'm sorry.
The efficiency under fossil fuel. What the governor wants to do is highlight the importance of energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is one of those kinds of things that frequently gets, I'll just sort of say, less attention, even potentially shortchanged, when we think about in the context of more renewables and even in the carbon context, now that the governor has pursued that. And what he wants to sort of say, this is very important, and I want to integrate. What his message to me is that I now need to make sure my staff is now focusing on that issue. He wants to basically work with you and other stakeholders on how we can improve our energy efficiency efforts. He's identified two specific ideas. One is the transition of SIP. The other is more energy efficiency buildings. But we do it all the time. Promotion of Energy Star appliances. Making sure the consumer understands that when they basically buy a product, that it has energy implications. Those are the kinds of things that you don't necessarily legislate, you educate. And so those are the kinds of tasks that my staff is now working on to develop. And not to say that we don't already have them, to enhance them and spend more attention on. But that is the goal of saying energy efficiency is important. Here's what I want to do. I'm now putting a yardstick out to measure our performance.
Members, I'm sure there will be other questions, but our time is getting short, and I think we should proceed to Assistant Commissioner Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's really good to be here and good to see all of you. Before we moved on, one of the things I wanted to mention is one of the things that was left off of Bob's list. And I think I understand why. It was a bill that we worked on last session on mercury emissions reduction that Eddie and I and Dave Thornton, Assistant Commissioner at PCA, worked on, spearheaded, and got through work, I think, with a lot of folks here to get that bill passed. Representative Hackbarth was the chief author. And it was, some folks consider it a pollution control more than an energy legislative package. But that was, I think that's something that I wanted to make you all aware of, that going through the list that Bob went through, Ed and I were in various capacities over that period, were intimately involved in putting a lot of that together as sort of the go back and forth, the Starsky and Hutch of Minnesota energy policy, or
Laurel and Hardy.
Laurel and Hardy. Siegfried and Roy. But what I'm working on, what I have been working on since 2005, I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Renewable Energy. I think the first commissioner-level appointee in the state's history directed specifically on developing the state's renewable resources. And in 2006, in the Governor's State of the State Address, set a goal, committed the state to a strategic goal of having all the energy, 25% of all the energy we use, transportation, electricity, natural gas, industrial heating and processing, etc., come from renewable resources by 2025. We brought that out in the State of the State, but when we ended up working last session on the mercury bill. But this year we're coming back with a bunch of initiatives that you'll see in the next gen piece to start fleshing that out. So one of those is to beef up the current renewable energy objective, which Mr. Eliff mentioned is currently 10%. The utilities are required to make a good faith effort to have 10% of their supply portfolio from renewable resources by 2015. We're going to be, on the basis of the utility compliance currently, what we know about the technology and the resources that are available now, and how critical it is that we start addressing greenhouse gas emissions. We think it's time to beef that up, to expand the REO to 25% of the electricity we use come from renewable resources by 2025, and add some additional teeth. When we passed the bill in 2001, It was a requirement that the utilities make a good faith effort, but there wasn't any teeth behind it. And since that time period, and Bob mentioned a few of these, we've continued to firm up the REO, and now we're proposing to add a penalty of 5 cents per megawatt hour for the amount of that a utility is short during a reporting period, if the utility has not made the good faith effort. We're going to retain that concept of good faith effort in our proposal, primarily because by doing so, we get the firmness that, you know, the requirement, essentially, the standard that utilities, that the renewable advocates and others believe is necessary in order to get the kinds of renewable resources into the system that we all want. And at the same time, we retain the flexibility to mitigate unintended consequences and avoid problems that are associated sometimes with mandates. So that'll be our proposal. The good faith effort has been implemented in a way that requires the utilities to do everything they reasonably can to add renewables to the system. And there they are doing so, and they're all ahead of the game in terms of their REO compliance, except for a couple. And we'll be issuing a report next week detailing utility compliance with the renewable energy objective. So in the sense that the good faith effort is a requirement on the utilities to do everything they reasonably can to meet the REO targets, it allows the REO to be a much more targeted renewable energy policy than a one-size-fits-all approach, because the context for what for what a utility can reasonably be expected to do, it changes. It changes over time, changes due to the conditions of the service territory, the utility is operating in, how well the economy is doing, etc. One example is if a region of the state, if the economy of a region of the state, say the Iron Range, which is now seems to be doing well again, but if we're to head south again, we would be under the REO, you would be able to take the opportunity to look at whether or not Minnesota Power would need to continue to add resources in the face of that downturn in the economy. Whereas under the potentially under an RES as proposed, a renewable standard, that would be more of an automatic decision, and folks would have to come back to you. So we were proposing the REO, next generation renewable energy objective, as a smart renewable standard, and we're going to be, that'll be in the package that we'll be bringing to you. One of the key things that's in that renewable energy objective is specific mechanisms to promote community energy. Local ownership of energy production is a critical component to this administration's energy policy, and we've seen the benefit of local ownership of energy production in the ethanol industry, and how those farmer-owned cooperative plants have acted as economic anchors for those rural economies in which they were developed. And we have been working steadily on community-owned wind projects since the bill was passed in 2005, promoting CBED, community-based energy development, which Bob did refer to as an unfortunate acronym, and I'm afraid I have to agree with him at this point, but it's in the law. So we'll be having specific mechanisms in the proposal to promote community energy development and continue to do that. There are two other pieces to the governor's next-gen renewable energy component. First, we talked about the electricity side. We're also going to have a big push on the fuel side. Ed mentioned, I think, that we're going to have we'll be putting money in the budget for what we refer to as E85 everywhere, making sure that E85 pumps are as convenient and accessible as possible for consumers. We have a nation-leading 300 pumps currently, but it's still 300 pumps. You have to really work hard to find, if you're on the road, to find an E85 pump, and that makes it hard for folks. So we're looking to have another 1,500 pumps for a total of 1,800 pumps by 2010, and we'll have money in the budget to help offset the cost to station retail station owners for installation of those pumps. The third component, we'll be looking at there'll be money in the budget for developing or continuing to develop the biomass energy industry in the state. We have a ton of biomass. Well, more than a ton. We have a lot of biomass. And
hopefully more than that. Okay.
And we're finding that the technology for thermal conversion of biomass to offset natural gas use, either directly through combustion or through gasification, is being implemented now in the state, and we want to see that more broadly implemented. We've got some of the farmer-owned cooperative ethanol plants that are implementing this technology. Winnebago, Benson, and Little Falls, the farmer-owned plants in those communities are implementing biomass thermal conversion technologies to offset their natural gas use, and are producing some of the most renewable energy, renewable ethanol in the country, in the world, right here in our state. So we'll be looking to promote that technology, as well as moving into the next generation of biofuels, cellulosic biofuels, and we'll have money in the budget for that as well. For this committee's information, we will be carrying the funding for the E85 Everywhere program, so I expect that will come through this committee. The Ag Department will have the biomass, the bioenergy components in their budget, and I'm sure they'd be thrilled to come talk to you in more detail about some of this. So, Mr. Chair, that's the next generation energy, the renewable energy components of the governor's energy initiative.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. One question about the E85 component of this. Can you tell us what the current situation is with regard to vehicles that are capable of using E85 and what you anticipate with that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are over 100,000 vehicles in the state now that can use that are flex fuel vehicles that can use E85. The vast majority, obviously, are not using, partially because it's hard to find. We've seen a strong interest, specifically on the part of GM and others, to increase not only the numbers of E85 flex fuel vehicles that are available, but the kinds, the types, and the varieties. And that was a big concern. Is when we went to buy our E85 vehicle this past year, it was a Dodge Caravan. You had to the E85, the flex fuel model, only came with one set of stuff. You couldn't get the cool captain chairs, and you couldn't get, you had to take the bench seats, and so you need to be able to have all of that cool stuff in order to make it accessible for consumers, and I think they're showing an interest in doing that. Another point that I think folks should know about is we're working with Mankato State University, or whatever they're called now. Dr. Bruce Jones down there at the Center for Auto Research is working on getting some E85 conversion kits certified federally by the federal EPA, which they will essentially, at a fairly reasonable cost, be able to turn any new vehicle into a flex fuel vehicle and be able to use E85 fuel. And that would solve that specific vehicle problem almost overnight as soon as we can get that certified.
And Mr. Bull, what's the situation with state vehicles? Is there anything in the proposal dealing with state vehicles?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in 2004, the governor issued this Smart Fleet Executive Order, which set some very aggressive goals for gasoline and petroleum reduction use, and part of that was an increase in the use of E85 and biodiesel in the fleet, as well as just overall decrease in miles traveled. And I haven't seen a recent report, but I'm sure the Department of Administration has that, and I'll get that information to the committee as soon as I can.
Thank you. We're just about out of time here, but if members have a couple of quick questions. Representative Kale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioners, a follow-up to the question about the state fleet. I know that these numbers generally don't show up on the state budget, but we have pretty significant fleets all over the state that carry our school children safely and hopefully more efficiently. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on the capacity for more production of biodiesel statewide, and then also some of the what are the roadblocks, pardon the pun, for expanding the use of biodiesel among our state fleet and then also among our other individual fleets and local governments and school districts. Thank you very much.
Sir, members, well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I think the best answer to the question is that we're ready to increase the use of biodiesel. We currently, for the members who may not know, we have a 2% biodiesel blending requirement currently in law for each gallon of diesel fuel has 2% biodiesel. That was implemented a year ago, and I think the question, we had some quality control problems in the fuel, and in the blended fuel through that winter, and we've been working very hard during that period to identify the problems and to work through those. All of our biodiesel plants since then have become what's called BQ 9000 certified, which is the quality control standards and processes that are required. It's a very high level of quality control, and all of them now are certified as BQ 9000. I think the big question is, let's make sure we get through another winter before we move more aggressively on biodiesel. And I think the next step would be an easy move to B5.
So I have Representative Brennerton, Representative Hackworth, and we're virtually out of time, so if we could keep it brief.
Just a real quick question, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I'm wondering about research dollars. Are there any research dollars in this proposal?
Mr. Ball.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brenner, there will be, is my understanding, but that's a budget in the budget that's not yet announced. I'm afraid I can't share that.
Representative Hathaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Eloff put out this list and talked about a number of the things, a number of accomplishments that we've made in this area of energy. And there's a number of people on both sides of this table that enacted a lot of these accomplishments. So we, more than just the chairs that you have on this committee, we have a wealth of knowledge on this committee. And not only that, but in the audience, there's a number of people that helped put this legislation together. And so we've got a lot of people here that did a lot of good work. And I just wanted to mention a little bit about what Mike Bull mentioned earlier in his opening comments, that about the mercury reduction bill that we passed in 2006.
Yes.
And the governor's lead that he took on that to pass the legislation, national leading legislation. We outperform the national standards, the national regs that were put in place. We're number one in the nation with this legislation. And the two gentlemen sitting at the table up here, the deputy commissioner and the assistant commissioner, helped put that legislation together and helped put that forward. And they did a very, very good job, and I just wanted to thank them and recognize them for the great effort that they did on that bill. So I'm sure they're going to do a good job on the new proposal that the governor is bringing forward. And I just wanted to end the committee with that, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sure they will. I'm really looking forward to working with them and all the members of the committee, and thank you for bringing that up as a very good reminder. With that, we're still working on the agenda for next week. We will not be meeting on Monday because of Martin Luther King Day. We're getting cheated out of meetings for a number of reasons coming up, so we'll have to try to squeeze in everything we can. But the agenda for next week, for next Wednesday, will be published well before then, and we'll continue with basically some background and overview for the next couple of meetings. So with that, if there are no further questions or comments, the meeting is adjourned.